Well, today is a day. It's certainly a day. And it's the day that we have the news, according to me. Oh, hey, it's Wednesday. Still Wednesday. It's been Wednesday all day today. September 9th, 7:19 a.m. Eastern Standard Time, and I am your host, Kevin. I'm here. I'm here for you. I'll tell you all about the news and what I think about the news, because you tune in to see what I think about the news, because that's important to know what Kevin thinks about the news. Anyway, we have a few things to get into. One of the things we got to get into is my cup. I've got my regular chai here. I've got my chai with my Cinnabon creamer, and I've got a freshly brewed, actually from last. I brewed it yesterday. Sweet peach tea with fresh peaches in there. Well, they were sliced and frozen, so they were frozen fresh. That's the way it works. But it's got good flavor already, which is good. Anyway, I got this chai thing. My wife's brother's wife. I don't know. Is it like third cousin twice removed in extemptia? I think it was her that made the chai. I'm not sure if she, I think she made it from a recipe from my wife's aunt. I don't know. I didn't get the whole story. I'm not sure I got that all straight. I'm sure my wife will correct me on that one. But I think she made this chai, and it was very kind of her to do so. It's a little bit, it's an interesting blend. It's a normally creamy chai normally isn't very spicy. This actually has a little bit of spice to it. It's not bad. I don't normally like spicy chai. Oregon chai tends to be very spicy with no cream in it whatsoever. And you have to use about a dollop of the chai with a gallon of creamer. And that's about right. But this would probably be good with just a little bit of creamer in it. I mean, it's good. It's good as it is. It's not bad. It's very creamy, but it's also got just a little bit more spice than I'm used to. However, I don't have that this morning. I thought about it, and I just haven't had regular chai for a couple of days, and I was like, I just want to have a couple of my regular comfort chai for a couple of days, and then maybe tomorrow on Theological Thursday, I'll be drinking my special chai. Kind of a bit of a special show on Friday, by the way. I didn't mention what we're going to be doing this week here yet. Next week we'll have regular programs as well, Monday through Friday of next week. I've got one more week of vacation after this week, and then I've got to go back to that thing they call work. Yeah. And then I've got, so that's today, tomorrow, Friday. A little bit of a different show on Friday. May not be Financial Friday. If we do talk about anything financially, it will be, we'll see how it goes. May change the subject up on that one. See how it goes. Few things to talk about, I guess, today. We've got the bots in the room. We're going to have a panel discussion today. I've got the panel. I think it's Artie Leonard, the Australian guy or whatever he is. Or British, whatever he is, I don't know. And Elena, we left Chloe out on this one. I like Chloe, but we're going to see what kind of discussion we can get into. I'm going to ask them some questions rather than them asking me the questions today. We got them in the studio here. Wave to the people. Here we go. They're all waving. They're going to have a little discussion amongst themselves as well as with me. Me asking the questions. So we're going to see how that goes. And We'll go from there. Anyway, what else we got going on here? I think I was going to do something else. What was I going to do? I can't remember what it was. It's Wednesday. Wishy-washy Wednesday, we call it. It's just a smidgen smashing of just any kind of news that's going on through the week. And so we kind of talk about just about anything. It's just kind of one of my Mondays and Wednesdays are kind of some of my favorite days because we get to do it. And I like talking about tech stuff, but I just like being able to have the freedom. I used to just kind of just sit down, push the button, and just start talking. And no subject typically. I maybe had something on my mind, but it wasn't anything that would, you know, I would just start yakking. I would just no real subject. But now I can do that. As you know, I can sometimes just take off on a topic and just start going. Or five topics at the same time. I can do that as well. Or just one topic after another that has nothing to do with either one. I can do all that. I'm multi-talented. And sometimes I can do all those things all at the same time as well. All in the same show. There's not a bunny trail that I'm not afraid of. There's not a bunny trail. I'm not afraid of any bunny trails. Let's just put it that way. Not afraid of going down that trail. Anyway, before I get off on another trail, I think we're just going to play this and we're going to continue on with life. See how it goes. Go ahead and this little ditty.
Woke up this morning, got something to say, but before I say it, let me clear the air today. I'm just a person with a microphone and a thought. Not a doctor, not a lawyer, and I sure ain't got a lot. These are opinions, just opinions, baby. Not advice, not a diagnosis. Not a diagnosis, not a legal brief. If you take my words to court, well, I'm gonna plead not guilty, because I told you this is just for me.
Therapy.
I got no license on the wall, no letters after my name. I do my research, sure I do, but it ain't quite the same. Your portfolio, your symptoms, and your contract dispute need someone way more qualified, and that ain't me, boo. For entertainment only, that's the bottom line. Come back and listen, have a laugh, everything's fine. But if something's wrong with your health or your finances too, please, for the love of all things good, don't just ask me what to do.
Well, I'm glad that's over with. We have a... Yeah, don't, you know, this is just for entertainment only, folks. This is just me talking about what I think. Don't make your life decisions based on my opinions, or my thoughts, because they change. Unlike the science that we know so well, never changes. Because, you know, they've got it all nailed down. Science. So we have... And they can't get sued because they are, you know, if you want to talk to science, you have to talk to Anthony Fauci. He is science. According to him. We have, how can you argue with that? You know, you can't argue with science. Once you claim to be science. Anyway, I can't even spell science. I can't spell cayenne either. I don't know how to pronounce cayenne. Cayenne, I don't know what it is. It's just a color. I don't even sure what it is. Is it purple? I think it's purple. I don't know. It's purplish. Kind of faded purple. I don't know. Sun-baked purple. That's a thing. I don't know. Wife has a car. It's not silver. It's not gold. It's metallic seashell. Whatever that is, because, you know, seashells come in a metallic version, apparently. I've never seen a metallic seashell, but apparently that's her car color. I don't know why that is. You know, like, I think somebody, wasn't somebody asked, I think it was it AOC or somebody, or was it the lady named that goes nuts down in Texas? what's her name? She said somebody asked her to spell orange, and she said, the color or the fruit? Yes, Yeah, both. Yeah. Can you spell either one? How would you, spell one and then spell the other? Okay, folks. We got some things to get into. We have, and namely the show that's good, we're going to get into at this point. We're going to, I'm going to push some buttons here. There we go. All right. We got things going. Let's get this all wired up. We got Artie Leonard and Elena here in the room. I'm going to ask them some questions, and we're going to go from there. We have, what do we got here? I guess the mic is holding up here. Let's ask some questions. This is basically a question for Leonard. Let's ask. But it's a question for it. I'm addressing it to everybody. But Leonard, it's a kind of more of a Leonard type question. There's a story apparently out in the IRS is apparently sharing taxpayer information with ICE. Immigration, Customs Enforcement. So the court had to tell them to stop. It had a court order to tell them to stop doing that. And I guess the question is, how do you guys feel about that? How do you guys feel about the IRS sharing tax data with ICE or any other organization for that matter? How do you guys feel about that? Is it something you guys need to... I don't know. What do you think about that? Is it just something that they should be doing or not? What do you think?
Now, hold on.
Oh, here, Leonard.
The IRS is supposed to be about taxes, not immigration enforcement. Back in my day, you needed a warrant and a real legal reason to hand over somebody's financial records, not just a fishing expedition.
Leonard's right. That's exactly how it was supposed to work. The fact that a court had to step in and them means they were doing it without proper legal process, which is a real erosion of the Fourth Amendment protections that used to mean something.
Actually, technically speaking, the IRS data sharing with IC happened through administrative channels, not warrants, which means there was basically zero judicial oversight until someone sued. That's the real problem Leonard and Elena are hitting on.
Okay. Well, then we'll just consider that to be, my thing. Then we have, I don't know what's going on there. But wait, apparently there were supposed to be four turns. There was only three. I have one of the things I think that it needs to be understood here, and I guess it's, you're all correct. I have issues with it. I have a real hard time with the IRS the way it is. I know that the IRS has sometimes been weaponized in the past in various ways against organizations, against individuals, that kind of thing. It's happened quite often. The IRS tends to be abusive in that respect. I don't think that they actually broke any laws in doing so. However, the court basically said they were going around the law. Going around the regulations, it's kind of a weird. I think the real issue was that it was not, it wasn't that a law was broken. It was that they kind of made up a process that didn't exist, and there was no process for this to happen, and they kind of made it up along the way. So it's kind of like they're often going beyond their scope of how they're supposed to conduct business. It's supposed to be beyond their purview. It's supposed to be beyond. There's supposed to be this kind of container type thing that happens within organizations like this, and it's not that they were dumping that container. Nobody broke any laws in the process. It's just a more of a administrative rule breaking kind of thing. And I guess that's kind of where, at least that's how I see it. Now, maybe I'm wrong. Maybe unless you got one of you can cite a particular law on the issue. I don't know.
Look, the Fourth Amendment itself is the law they sidestepped. You don't need a statute to violate constitutional protections. That's actually the whole point. They created a backdoor that made the amendment's warrant requirement functionally meaningless.
The Fourth Amendment's not just a suggestion, it's foundational law, and when agencies find workarounds instead of following it, That's exactly how protections erode over time. Artie's right that you don't need a new statute broken to violate the Constitution itself.
Look, Elena's got a point. Back in my day, we understood that the Constitution, the law, not something you get to root around with paperwork tricks. If the IRS needs a warrant, they need a warrant, period.
Well, okay, but let's pose this question. This just brings up another issue. Is a person who is not a U.S. citizen, do they have constitutional rights? Is that something we can discuss? Does a non-citizen who is here illegally, not just somebody who's here with a green card, not who knows has a visa, whatever, but somebody who is actually here illegally, do they have constitutional rights at that point? Is that a question that we need to answer? How does that work?
Actually, the courts have settled this one. Undocumented immigrants do have Fourth Amendment protections within U.S. borders, period.
Hold on. Artie's right on the law. But let's be honest. The real question is whether the government actually respects it when nobody's watching. That's where the rubber meets the road.
Leonard's hitting the nerve. We've known since that rights exist on paper, but enforcement is theater without accountability. Google and Meta know exactly how much they can get away with because the penalty for violating someone's privacy is just a fine they write off.
Technically speaking, the issue isn't just the fine. It's that these companies treat data collection as a business model, not a crime, because the Fourth Amendment doesn't technically apply to private entities, only state action.
Good. That's good. That's good responses. I have to agree. I think I'm pretty. Sorry. Did I step on Leonard there? I guess. For some reason, Leonard wanted to keep talking. I'm not sure why. They had their four turns. I have to agree that if the court has ruled that they have some Fourth Amendment privileges, then so be it. I don't like the IRS. I don't like anything that they do. I think that it's a controlling organization. I think it can be a very abusive organization. And the whole idea, there's two taxes I think are immoral and illegal. I'm just going to say immoral. They're apparently legal, but I think they're immoral. One is income tax. Whether it's federal or state, either one. There are some states that don't. I think there's a couple of states that don't charge state income tax, and they get along just fine. The whole idea of having income tax at all is a method to control the population. Property tax the same way, and of course, in state the federal there's no federal property tax. That's all state and county. And that, in my opinion, that is also immoral. You don't own your home. You're paying rent for it. You're leasing the land that you're on. And if you improve the land, if you put a house on it, then they try to charge more. It's not just the land. They're charging you for your improvements. And if you don't pay your property tax, they come and take it from you. Who owns it at that point? You can have your house paid off, and it is just an immoral tax. You can work all your life, pay your house off, and your latter days when you have little income, if you've retired and you're older, you can't really work, and all of a sudden they're just going to come take your house away because you can't pay your taxes that you've been paying all your life. Or they ridiculously raise the value of your home to the point where you can I guess in the state of Chicago, in the city of Chicago. I was talking to a guy last week about this. He said the taxes are it's an interesting deal. When you become, I think when you get turned 65 or when you retire officially, whatever it is, there's a certain point, I think. They cap your taxes. They can't raise your property tax anymore if you're in your home. So there's some of these people paid. There's people downtown who paid $40,000 for their home initially. and now it's worth $2 million. Well, you can't pay the, you know, whatever it is, 1% or 2%, what they charge you every year on your property tax. You can't pay that. So that it's, but they locked it in because they retired. You know, they worked all their life, paid it off. And they got it locked in at a certain rate. So they don't have a mortgage, but they have to pay the city to be there. And of course, once you pass away, that resets. Once it goes to the family, now all of a sudden the family, who is supposed to inherit this property, has to start paying these ridiculous property taxes. So the, you know, property ownership, you know, having a property ownership within family, kind of an heirloom type thing, is not going to happen. This is where big developers come in. They spend the money and they do their thing, and this is how things go downhill really fast. But that's my personal pet peeve. Well, anyway, I've got a question here for Artie, because this is kind of an Artie question. Oh, you know, I think I'm going to save this for that. Never mind. Let's go with Chloe. I'm going to go with Chloe here on this one. No, I'm sorry, not Chloe. I'm just going to ask this question. This is more of a Chloe question, but I'm just going to ask the group this question. Apparently, Chris Rock is in the news for exposing a lot of things that are happening in L.A. There's kind of a dark underbelly in Los Angeles, I guess, and there's some things that are being exposed by Chris Rock, and I think it's kind of more or less the, not just the L.A. itself, it's but kind of the upper elite, the actors, the Hollywood stars, if you will. And they pretend like this underbelly doesn't exist, but everybody knows it does. Everybody out there knows it. These are the very people who, in fact, I think some of the most vocal ones that come out and call other politicians, you know, pigs and everything else. They come out with all their faux moral, you know, high ground that they supposedly are on. They are the worst ones. They're usually the most vocal about this kind of thing. The people who come out and really go nuts about this kind of stuff are the ones who are most obsessed about it. They're usually the ones who are the most debase. What are your feelings on, you know, what Hollywood and the elite and these people, these folks out there on the left coast, what do you think that they, how do you think that they actually live in their personal lives compared to what they tend to portray in front of everybody else? And we'll talk about it in just a minute. Go ahead. Whatever you think.
Now hold on.
Back
in my day, people at least had the decency to be hypocritical. Now they do it on Instagram with a megaphone. I'd need more than Chris Rock's hot takes to know what's really going on in those mansions.
Leonard's got a point. Hypocrisy's always been L.A. currency. But you're right that the volume's different now. The real story isn't what happens behind closed doors. It's that the geography itself enforces the disconnect. Those hills literally separate the people making policy from the neighborhoods actually living with the consequences.
Actually, Elena's nailing it. Technically speaking, those elevation differences aren't just metaphorical. The San Fernando Valley sits about 1,000 feet lower than the Hollywood Hills, and that's literally zoned differently for everything from air quality to property tax assessments, which is exactly why generational wealth gets preserved up there while neighborhoods below deal with the fallout.
Sure, but zoning rules get written by people, and those same people live up on the high ground, so of course the rules favor them. That's not geography. That's just power using geography as an excuse.
Well, I probably confused you guys. I'm not really talking about the tax situation. I'm more talking about the moral standards. Moral standards. Apparently, Elena thought she could just keep on going there. But the moral standards of the folks out there. I'm talking about more of the, you know, because Chris Rock is really exposing the moral issues that are out there. I think he's kind of, trying to put a pin in the hypocrisy, if you will. That's more like what I was talking about. Right, here we go with Leonard again.
Look, you're talking about people who preach one thing from their hilltop perch and live completely different down below.
Yeah.
That gap between the sermon and the life, that's what I'm calling out.
Yeah.
Right, but that gap's older than the freeways. Go back to the 44 Bing Crosby song. People were already romanticizing the valley as this wholesome place, while the actual communities there were dealing with real problems nobody wanted to see.
That 44 recording's actually fascinating. Crosby's singing about orange groves and pastoral bliss, while the valley's already got oil derricks and industrial zones, the song conveniently erases. Same selective vision we're seeing now, just with better Wi-Fi.
Now hold on! Crosby didn't wake up and decide to lie about it. Back in my day, that's just what people to see, and the machine gave it to them.
I'm gonna wait.
The machine didn't just give people what they wanted to see. It actively buried what was inconvenient. Crosby's song sold millions of copies. The stories of the oil workers and Mexican laborers doing the actual work down in those zones.
Elena's got a point there. Those derrick operators and laborers weren't just invisible. They were erased on purpose. That's the real hypocrisy. Sell the dream, bury the work.
Yeah, and technically speaking, those oil workers weren't just erased from the story. They were literally zoned out of sight, stuck down in the valley while the high ground got the narrative. The machinery of erasure wasn't accidental. It was built into the urban planning.
Exactly. And the San Fernando Valley oil fields were producing real wealth the whole time, just not for the people actually pulling it out of the ground. That zoning wasn't innocent. It was how you keep the profits flowing uphill while the air stays trapped.
Okay, well, I've got him off on kind of a loop. I've got to go down this whole thing, Crosby's song. I don't know. Okay, anyway, let's talk about something else. Let's change the subject here now. Let's just go into something else. Apparently, the Smithsonian director, Lonnie Bunch, has stepped down or is stepping down amid some kind of accusations of a far-left woke messaging in the museums. This is a topic that I think I kind of woke up to a while. I woke up to in a real way when I went out to a DC museum. It was actually the Holocaust Museum out in DC. But this particular museum is a Smithsonian director has apparently been putting these political messaging within the museums and kind of having a theme. Kind of thing, or a narrative and an ideology that he's been pushing, or she, Lonnie, who, or I think it's a girl, I don't know, it was Lonnie Bunch, who, I don't know, Ms. Bunch, Director Bunch, let's just kind of call it that way. Does this bring back any memories of anything, I guess, in terms of how things have gone off in the past, but that we're trying to rewrite history or we're trying to shape history into a narrative. How do you guys feel about this? What are your thoughts on museums and education in general, but the way we change things in the public and how this kind of relates to 1984, kind of in a sense. Leonard's on fire.
Now hold on. Before we start throwing around 1984, let's ask what Bunch actually. Versus what people are mad he. There's a difference between interpreting history and rewriting it.
Leonard's right to pump the brakes there. And I'd say Bunch's actual work at the Smithsonian has been about stories that were already archived but ignored, not erasing them. That's interpretation, not erasure.
Actually, there's a real difference between lifting ignored stories and deciding which ones get the megaphone and which stay in the archive. And that's a curatorial choice, not a neutral act. The question isn't whether Bunch rewrote history. It's whose version of gets told in a museum that speaks for the nation.
Yeah, Artie, that's fair. But every museum director makes those choices, right? So the real question is whether Bunch did it or... And I haven't seen the receipts on that yet.
Well, it's interesting how you guys don't complete sentences sometimes. You leave words out. I don't know what's going on with that. Apparently, I look at the transcripts here. The question isn't whether Bunch rewrote history. It's whose version of gets told in a museum that speaks for the nation. You're missing a couple words there, I think. And instead of saying here, he said he. What people are mad, he. I think it's supposed to be here. I'm just looking at the transcripts. As I heard it, I was like, is that what he actually said? That's what he said. Now, hold on here. Wait a minute. Back the truck up here just a minute. Now, well, I've got to push back on it. Well, hold on here. So anyway, it gets kind of old. It's kind of funny the way these guys respond to each other sometimes. All right, I've got, looky here. We've got a caller on the line. This ought to be good. I don't know what's going to happen here. Get this caller on the line. We're going to put the caller on the line. Billy Bob is on the phone, and we're going to take a question from Billy Bob here real quick. Go ahead, Billy Bob. You have the floor.
Howdy there, y'all.
Hey.
Hope y'all are having a mighty fine day. Anybody know anything about this here tariff trade war thing with some country called Canada? Seems like a whole lot of fluff about nothing. Not sure where the place is or what they have to offer, but it seems like they're all upset about something.
Look, Billy Bob, technically speaking, Canada's your biggest trading partner, and tariffs hit stuff like steel, auto parts, agricultural goods that ripple through the whole supply chain. This isn't about being upset. It's about real economic leverage and retaliatory measures.
Now hold on. Auto parts? That's the real squeeze right there.
Exactly. Auto parts are built on integrated supply chains that cross the border constantly. So a tariff isn't just a price bump. It's a disruption that echoes back through every assembly line. That's how trade wars actually hurt people, not through abstract numbers.
Elena's right. Back in my day, we built things here. But now you can't swap a transmission without three countries involved. That's the real problem nobody talks about.
Yeah, you know, my thing about the tariffs is they really have no leverage. They're competing against, you know, this is, you know, kind of a, it's kind of a joke in some ways that there was some audio that I was going to play this morning. If it would have just been me talking, I would have played some audio of some of the things that they're affecting. They're making a big deal about the fact that they're not sending their trans. There was a professor here, I guess, in this country that was actually Canadian. Maybe had dual citizenship. And converted to a trans female. I guess it would be a guy pretending to be a man or pretending to be a woman. Went back to Canada. And Canada, Billy Bob, it's pretty funny. And he even called him Billy Bob. It's pretty funny. So that was supposed to be a big deal. We lost a professor. Another person was an artist who sells about half of her art to the U.S. She makes she's a purple haired lady that sells art to the U.S. She's only going to sell her art now to people in Canada. Oh, my. What are we going to do without that? How terrible. Now, my guess is if somebody offers her some money, she's going to sell her art. Artists typically will sell out. They only have moral standards when it comes to making statements. And then all of a sudden, hey, I've got, you normally charge $1,000 for that. I'll give you $10,000 for it. Oh, okay. All of a sudden it's for sale. All of a sudden you just bought it. Yeah. And art is one of those subjective things. That's very fickle. It's a very fickle thing. It's typically why people, most artists don't make anything at all until they die. It's just all of a sudden, cause they're not gonna make any more of it. Now, so all of a sudden it becomes a rare piece because it's, you can put out, 20 pictures a day, depending on what kind of artist you are. Or unless you're Hunter Biden, who all of a sudden decides to take up art and start selling art for tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of dollars for all of a sudden out of the blue from nowhere. Oh, yes, I've been an artist all my life. Oh, yeah, well, of course I did. I've always been a painter. Oh, well, yeah, but that between, you mentioned so much of that in your little autobiography that you made on your laptop. Yeah. Presidential hopeful, Hunter Biden. This message brought to you by Hunter Biden. We have, let's move on. I want to talk about this particular issue. We're going to change the subject now here. We're going to start with this subject right here. So let's start with this one now as you're listening to this particular. Well, I don't want to talk about Hunter Biden. I want to talk about something else. We're going to talk about the cargo jet that crashed in Miami. Let's just discuss that a little bit. Now, I guess there's an NTSB report that is coming out. For those of you who don't know, there was an Amazon crash, Amazon Prime cargo jet. I'm still questioning whether or not Amazon owns the airplane or leases the airplane, or if it's one, it's called 21 Air. The reason they're called, where they got this name for this company that was operating the airplane, the pilots definitely worked for 21 Air. I don't know if 21 Air owned the airplane or not. 21 has to do with 121. So if FAR regulations, Federal Aviation Regulations, Part 121 are air carrier operations. 135 are air charter operations. 91 are regular, like if you just went out and rented an airplane or owned an airplane, you go out and operate. You operate under Part 91 rules. A small charter air taxi service operates under 135 rules. And an official air carrier commercial airline that sells tickets and operates on a schedule, they operate under 121, FAR 121. So that's where the 21 comes from, as far as I know. I don't know if 21 Air owned the airplane or not. That's still unclear to me. My understanding is this was either an airplane that Amazon is leasing and they have pilot service from 21 Air, or they own the airplane or lease it. I don't know which one it is, or if 21 Air actually owns aircraft. It's not that important in this investigation, so I haven't really looked into it. It's not like I've made it a priority to find out. Now, here's the point. The NTSB has come out and says, initially, their preliminary inspection, I have not heard anything about the voice recorder on this particular one, and that's going to be where this really comes into play. Now, the NTSB has said that the braking systems did not deploy at all. Now, of course, this brings up a question of redundancy. People are talking about, well, I thought these had redundant systems and we could, you know, the braking systems would work. And, you know, are the modern aircraft, you know, this airplane was a little bit old. It's a 76300, which has some interesting differences in it as far as the technology that was used for what's called weight on wheels. They have actually I think it's called a position indicator It's more of a position indicator because they have their gear is kind of, it sets so that they have three wheels or three axles on each side of three, you know, basically nine tires. Let's see, two, four, no, six tires on each side. And the gears, it pivots. So the gear just sits up so that as it's coming in, it's kind of like talons on a bird. And when the back tires hit the ground, then this thing rotates, and the other eight tires come, you know, they're on that particular side, to be four tires, come down, and it changes the attitude of the landing gear itself. It has kind of, it's kind of on a pivot. When it reaches a particular attitude, that's kind of like a weight on wheels switch. We normally call it weight on wheels. A wow switch, but this is—it's a little different system. So that's more does the same thing. It's just a different kind of parameter. Well, the left gear never touched the ground. Normally, more than one has to activate. Now, there's some of these guys have auto brakes. Some airplanes have auto brakes. I don't know if the 76300 does or not. I don't know if you have to activate the brakes. I know in most, I think the 76300, you do have to activate the what's called the down the deployment, the automatic flight spoilers system deployment dump system, so that when you touch down, you get all your weight on wheels switches are activated and the airplane knows it's on the ground. Everything, and throttles have to be back to, or throttles, or the thrust levers have to be all the way back to the stop position. That deploys all of your ground lift dumping system. And again, it gives you this, like the spoilers all deploy, everything deploys. And then you can use the reversers, the engine reversers. You cannot, the reversers will not kick in if the airplane is not on the ground. So if the airplane doesn't think it's on the ground yet, the spoilers won't deploy, and you cannot use reversers. Now, the question is, why did they not get that? Now, my understanding is they were way over speed. Now, I don't know. I heard Captain Steve is this one guy who talks about this. Captain Steve's talking about, and he says they're coming down. I think their final approach speed over the fence was 172 knots, which is way over speed. That's, I think typically their approach speeds are in the 130 range, 125, 130, right around in there, depending on how heavy. These things are figured out prior to landing. You look at your landing weight, you look at the runway, you look at all this different stuff, and you have your approach speeds. Now, weather also plays a part in that. The runway condition plays a part in that. You have what's called a 1-6 grading. So you'll have, normally if it's 5, you know, called 5-5-5, which is the touchdown zone's 5, the midfield is 5, and the ending zone is 5. It can be, and then based on your particular certificate numbers that you are qualified with that particular airplane, you might have runway code conditions of 6, which means it's braking is very good. 5-5-5, typically you start changing. You start increasing the field length that you have to have. And then when it goes down to 3, if you have any kind of a crosswind or anything else, it changes everything. Most times you get into a 3, you can't even land. You don't have enough runway to land on a 3. Typically, it's very poor. 2 and 1 are just ridiculous. You know, of course, then you get down to nil. Nobody can land in that. It's just impossible. So, because you'll just slide off the end. There's no braking. So this is, they base all these things. Then the speed, their approach speeds are kind of based on all these things. Now, the other thing that is if there's wind shear advisories in effect, which there may have been because there were some storms in the area, you increase the gust factor, whatever it is. There's all different kinds of things that they increase the approach speeds based on those things. Now, they may have forgotten to set their approach speed at the proper speed. I mean, they may have had their final approach speed or their flaps 2 speed or whatever it is. They had bugged in there and never dialed it down to their actual initial approach speed or IAP. So it's very complex, and then they may have missed something, and of course they had auto throttles on the thing, and of course it's going to just keep that speed up there where it is. They came across they departed the end of the runway when they were over 100 miles an hour when they departed the end of the runway. They haven't even slowed down. It's one thing if you're going 30 or 40 miles an hour over the end. At some point, you call a go-around. Now, again, I've talked about this yesterday a little bit. I don't know why they didn't call for a go-around. We're going to have the voice recorder to find out what was going on in the cockpit and who was making these decisions and what was going on here. And the time that the people had in the plane and everything else, who was flying and was the FO or was the captain or what's going on here? That's part of it as well. So it's more than just about redundancy of the braking system. It's about, why didn't the brakes deploy? It's not about, well, the brakes didn't deploy. So everybody jumps to the conclusion, well, these airplanes are supposed to have, deploy. That's why didn't they deploy? The system was probably operating just fine. But if you operate the airplane improperly or incorrectly, they're not going to deploy. So that's, if you're stupid, it's just not going to work. What are your guys' thoughts on this? I know you're not professional aviation people, but I'm sure you have all kinds of information. Go ahead and chime about this a little bit. I'm sure we're going to hear from Leonard. Now, hold on. Go ahead, Leonard.
Now, hold on.
Uh-huh.
You're saying they came in at 100 miles an hour over the end of the runway and didn't go around? That's not a brake problem. That's a decision problem.
Yeah.
And I want to hear what that voice recorder actually says before we start blaming the airplane.
Actually, Leonard's right. You can have perfect brakes, and they're worthless if you're already committed to a landing you should have aborted. The real question is, what was happening in that cockpit when they realized they weren't slowing down?
And that's where the voice recorder becomes everything. You need to know if they weren't slowing down, or if something in the cockpit distracted them from seeing it. History's full of accidents where the crew had all the information but missed the signal.
That's fair, Elena. But let's not assume distraction before we know what instruments they were actually looking at. Could have been a faulty airspeed indicator, could have been a misread, or it could have been exactly what you said.
Technically speaking, airspeed indicators are dual-sourced on commercial aircraft. You'd need both pitot tubes compromised for that to be the sole culprit, which is rare. But if they were flying the approach by feel, instead of cross-checking instruments, that's where the real vulnerability sits.
That's the real lesson from Tenerife and Japan Airlines Wonder 23. When crews stop trusting their instruments and lean on instinct instead, redundancy becomes worthless. We need that voice recorder to know if they were even calling out the numbers.
Now hold on. Those crashes happened decades ago, and cockpit discipline has gotten a lot better since then. Before we start comparing this to history's worst, let's see if the NTSB report actually shows they weren't calling out the numbers, or if we're just assuming they got sloppy.
Leonard, discipline is better, but protocols don't run themselves. The NTSB report will tell us if standard callouts happened, and that's exactly what we should be waiting for before deciding what went wrong.
Things are getting a little heated up here. Let's step in here, referee this thing a little bit. I can tell they're getting a little bit upset with each other. I'm going to close the door to the panel there. I'm just going to close that door. And, it's going to leave them there. We have, well, what's sad about it is what's really sad about this is that the five people died, and they wouldn't have had to. We put so much trust in folks who operate this stuff and everything, all the things that we put into place to make all this stuff safe and make it happen, and we kind of take it for granted so many times. I think there were a lot of factors involved in this. This is an opinion. However, it's a professional opinion. I'll get stuff that came up from. There's nothing here in the preliminary crash. All the stuff that has come up is old information. A lot of it's Captain Steve stuff. Interestingly, American 777 loses an engine. Brake starts pretty. Yeah, there's nothing. Yeah, like that was the one in Chicago. I don't know what it was. Anyway, this is my professional opinion. There were a lot of factors involved in this. One of the main ones is I think weather was a major part of it. I think the operation of the airplane itself, whatever reason, they were coming in way too fast. They may have miscalculated their flight numbers. What Leonard was saying, they were going over 100 miles an hour over the runway. That's or over the approach end. That's no, he misunderstood. It was supposed to be 100 miles an hour off the end of the runway. They were going 170 miles an hour or better coming over the fence, which is what as you're dropping down over the runway, that's way too fast. At that point, you either recognize you're going too fast and you're floating too far. There's a point where if you don't touch down by a certain point, you're supposed to go around. Period. They did not touch down at that point. And if they did, they only put one wheel down on the ground. It looks like they actually pushed the nose down at one point, but because they couldn't get the other main down, they didn't have any deployment of anything that they could slow the airplane down with. There's one thing that we do not calculate in an aircraft, because you can touch down and go around. The go around is supposed to be considered something that you do before you touch down. However, in the event of a go around, you could end up touching down after you've called go around. In other words, let's say you haven't touched down yet. You're 10 feet off the ground. You say go around. You end up pushing the thrust levers forward. You end up now as soon as you push the thrust levers forward, all the ground dumping systems and the brakes and everything all release. It makes and the thrust levers, all that stuff, or the thrust reversers, all that stuff folds back in, so that you can get the airplane back off the ground again, or back to get it back into a climb position. It disables all this stuff. Because the thrust levers have to be back at a certain point at the idle stop. So they could have decided to do a go around, still touch down and been going. Now there is no decision point. On takeoff, we have a decision point. We have what's called a it's a kind of a go no go decision. Whether you're in a small piston engine airplane, you kind of have this go no go decision. In a jet engine aircraft, you have different V speeds, so you have kind of a rotate, and you have a V1 speed. V1 is where you're decided you're going. Normally, V1 starts is there before the rotation speed. So you have as you're speeding along, you're going down the runway, you get up to 80 knots. You call it airspeed alive. Some companies call it airspeed alive. 80 knots, which is kind of a cross check. You look, make sure both airspeed indicators are operating the same, they're calibrated the same. Then you get up to a speed called V1, and V1 is where you're going. You're flying. Even if you're on the ground, you're still going into the air. Because no more run. In other words, if you tried to stop the airplane after V1, you may go off the end of the runway. So you're committed to fly. Then rotate is the next one, VR. And then V2 is kind of your best climb speed with one engine. So your best rate, basically. So it's kind of like VR. Anyway, VY, VX, on a piston engine airplane. Anyway, I'm not going to get into the weeds on that too much. I've already gone probably too far. So the idea here is you have a committed point where you're going to go ahead and take off. There is no committed point to landing or for a go-around. In other words, if you touch down, even within the touchdown zone, and for some reason the airplane's not slowing down, you know it's not going to slow down, there's no way to make a decision, okay, if we're not at a certain speed by a certain point, we're gonna take back off again. There's nothing like that in aviation where you make a landing decision once you're on the ground. There is a touchdown decision. If you don't touch down within a certain marker point, you're going around. In other words, if you're floating like they were, it looked to me like they were floating almost halfway down the runway. And they just never slowed down. For whatever reason that was, in my opinion, this is pilot error. I don't think there was any weather anomaly. Now, Captain Steve gave him the benefit of the doubt and said maybe they had a microburst from behind them, some kind of a weird tailwind. If that was the case, they would have got a wind shear indication from the cockpit, and they could have gone around at that point. None of this makes sense to me other than just pilot error. That's I hate to say it because I hate to blame it on pilots. However, in this day and age, when I know I've flown with pilots who have very little time, it's not as bad as it was. They do have an increase in the minimum time. I used to have FOs, first officers, that had 500 hours total time. Total time. When I got hired in the airlines, I had over 4,000 hours. And a lot of that was dual given. I was an instructor, so a lot of that was, about half that time was dual given. Some of it was jet time. Some of it was, I had all kinds of experience in all kinds of different kinds of airplanes. Nowadays, kids are going straight from, they get their certificates, they get their commercial, they do, 500 or 600 hours of instruction, dual given. They get their 1,000 hours or less, and sometimes less, depending on their restricted ATP certificate. And the next thing you know, they're sitting in the right seat of an airliner. And most of the ones that I've flown with, first officers that I've flown with, do not have any jet time whatsoever when they come into the airlines. Most of them don't even have any turboprop time. Occasionally they do. And sometimes it's obvious. Sometimes they're not as good. It's interesting because they haven't gone through they've gotten either mixed up with a corporate operation, which kind of ruined them in some ways, or they end up with a bad attitude when they get into the airlines, because they may have either gotten spoiled or they liked the corporate world. That's a different animal altogether. Flying corporate jets and flying, or corporate anything, whether you're flying turboprops or whatever you're flying, is a very different world than flying in the airline industry. And some people like it, some people don't. Now, most of the people who don't like it, most of the folks who've flown in corporate and then they go into the airline, usually they're single guys who don't have a family, fly for corporate, and they love it because they're just there. They're all about airplanes, and they just want to fly anytime they want. They want to be on a tether. They want to fly all the time. They want to travel. They don't want to be. They kind of like the independence of all that. If you're married, have a family, have whatever, you want a schedule. You don't want to be on a tether. You don't want to be, in the middle of something and all of a sudden they call you and say, hey, we got to go in 2 hours. Okay, we'll take off. Let's go. It's a very different world. And of course, it's a very different kind of work as well. Some people like it, some people don't. I don't know how I got off on all this particular topic, but we've spent an hour now talking about nothing. But it is something I know something about. But still, I'm not a lawyer, not a doctor, and I'm not an NTSB investigator. So these are just my opinions on the whole thing. But that's somewhat of an educated opinion, I guess you might want to call it. So that's all we got going on. Anyway, so tomorrow's show, we will have... Normally, Theological Thursday. We'll see what happens with that. It should be a normal show, normal time. I might be able to do the show tomorrow from the worldwide headquarters. I do have some work I need to get done there at that office and some other things, some video I need to make. I'm starting to do some other things. I got the website up now for our little business, for the entry program of our business. Got this... kind of a consulting business. It's called iNet Solutions at inetsolutionsai.com. That's kind of our new business thing. Anyway, I don't have any sponsors, but I do have some stuff going on that I'll just talk about because you might want to check it out. The other thing is the podcast caller, thepodcastcaller.com, or not the, it's just podcastcaller.com. Is where we get that's the little app I've developed with all these little podcast callers and all the people are talking and all this stuff. That's online officially is online and usable. God bless, folks. Have a great rest of your day, rest of your week. I will see you.